Holidays. For the average family in the 1950s, holidays were less ambitious than today. The era of package holidays, low-cost flights and city breaks at all times of the year was some time off. When I compare the holidays then, 1 week in the summer, with our own travels in recent years, it's of a completely different order. That's not to say my parents hadn't travelled already. My mum's WAF service in the war hadn't included any bombing missions over Germany, although after peace was declared, she did fly over Belgium and Germany one day in an RAF plane to see the damage, which was pretty sobering. More memorable to her was living in Jamaica for several years prior to grammar school back in the 1930s. We have photos of her and her brothers sitting with their parents on a veranda, shaded by palm trees and riding horses on sandy beaches. She would talk fondly of picking pineapples and avocados in the garden, as well as eating sugar cane. This all sounded very exotic in 1950s post-rationing Britain. My grandfather was a regimental sergeant major in the Royal Engineers and claimed to be in Jamaica building infrastructure, which sounds plausible. For part of the war, the family lived in Coventry, which was badly bombed, and at that time he was an air raid warden, so must have seen many opportunities for infrastructure repair. My own father had travelled extensively, firstly in his teens in the Merchant Navy on the SS Tewkesbury, and from what I remember, the sailings of this cargo ship included visits to ports in South America, South Africa, the USA and the Caribbean. His wartime travels included being evacuated from the beach at Dunkirk, service in the army in North Africa, Egypt, Italy, and Palestine. I'm not sure any of it could be described as a holiday, although he described Spike Milligan's humorous wartime memoirs as the most accurate portrayal of that time that he'd ever read. Our own family holidays were a lot nearer home. They often consisted of a car journey to stay with relatives, usually my Uncle Doug and his family, who lived between Gloucester and Cheltenham and was my mother's twin and in the RAF. It was also home to my cousins Helen and Amanda. The first holiday that I have only a vague memory of was to go by coach to Aberystwyth for us all to stay with my Auntie Minnie, my dad's aunt. This must have been before we had the family car, and I remember that it was the longest bus journey of my life at that time, up to 3 hours with stops. My brother was still in a pushchair, so I would have been 4 or 5. I can't recall much about the holiday other than that Aunt Minnie's house was by a bridge next to a river, and because of this I couldn't go outside unsupervised. Also, the beach was disappointedly stony, with us being used to the beautiful sandy beaches at home in Swansea Bay and Gower. There also seemed to be little in the way of seaside entertainment, although I think I had a donkey ride, which scared me. I do remember that there was a black range-type stove in the main room that seemed to be a combined kitchen-living room that I was warned not to touch, and it seemed very dark. Maybe it was gaslit in the house. Strangely, some years later, this scary holiday did not put me off spending a more pleasant 3 years there at university, which with generous student grants, cheap drink and good company, did seem more like a holiday. But the beach was still disappointingly stony. Another holiday with relatives was to stay with one of my mum's aunts in London. This was my first trip to the capital, and I guess I was about 9 or 10, and it was the first opportunity to see the sights that were familiar from books, films and television. We were promised we would see the Guards, Buckingham Palace, the Tower of London and Beefeaters, etc. I was excited about going on the London Underground, so that was definitely on my must-do list. Years later, when on working visits to the capital, I would avoid the Underground like the plague and opt to walk or take a cab. The journey must have been in the summer holidays, and the car was packed the night before and the family was up at the crack of dawn and set off before breakfast, stopping a couple of hours later for a picnic breakfast at the roadside. This was the 1950s British road system. Although sections of the M1 had recently been completed, the Swansea to London route was the old A48 through Chepstow, with the Severn Bridge crossing over the wide expanse of the Bristol Channel still in the planning stages. There were several other stops, but not just for refreshments and breaks. My dad still seemed to need to clean the plugs on the car every couple of hours to stop the misfiring. So all in all, the adventure took the entire time of a summer's daylight hours. I believe we didn't arrive until after dark, around 10:30 in London, or more correctly in Woodford Green, Essex, so northeast London. We were welcomed by my great aunt and her two sons, who, although they were my mum's cousins, were both between my age and my parents' age. My brother and myself went straight to bed, but we were promised that Derek and Robin would play cricket and take us fishing and kite flying. I guess it was the next morning that we set off to see the sights, unless my dad had to have a rest day locally after what must have been a tiring drive, punctuated by amateur car engine maintenance. Initially, on the sightseeing, I experienced a major disappointment. We entered the London Underground station in Woodford, and after taking our seats on our train, I was shocked when it emerged from the station to find we could still see trees and houses. My brother and me both exclaimed, "This isn't underground, it's just like a normal train." The next few stops were spent somewhat grumpily while we waited for my dad's promise that we would be going underground to be fulfilled. Of course, he was right. Although the noise of the trains amplified in the tunnel, I found rather unpleasant, and I was pleased to get out. I also didn't approve of the rickety wooden escalators that didn't seem as smooth as the smaller, more modern ones that we had infrequently encountered in department stores at home or in Cardiff. Still, we were out on the London streets, and it did seem busier and more crowded than towns of our previous experience. Over the next few days, my parents were as good as their word, and we visited all the promised sites. We must have walked our socks off. The crown jewels, Beefeaters and the ravens are all seen at the tower. At that time, there was no shuffling past the display cases and we could ogle the jewels at our leisure. Different times. We crossed the Thames and saw Tower Bridge as well as Hampton Court on a trip up the river. We ate in Lyons Corner House with the nippy waitresses in their uniforms, much posher than the upstairs Woolworths cafeteria at home. We visited the big shops in Oxford Street, amazed by their size, and window shopped in the Burlington Arcade. I guess we went to Liberty's, as I remember a Tudor-style building. Years later, it became my favourite London store, particularly as my designer wife had some textiles stocked and sold there, a mark of her talent as a designer, which made me extremely proud of her. One day, we couldn't wait to get back to tell Aunt Ivy of a stroke of luck that had occurred. When walking down the Mall to see Buckingham Palace, we saw a police escort of outriders coming down the road slowly, with horse guards and a coach, with the Queen waving as she went past. She was accompanied by, amongst others, a lady in brightly coloured clothes. We later found out it was the state visit of the King and Queen of Thailand. My dad claimed it was especially arranged for us, but we didn't believe him. The visit to the capital certainly met my expectations, and I've never really lost the slight sense of awe at the bustle and activity in the city. Many years later, I spent days there for business and went to places I couldn't imagine at 9 years of age. Several such experiences come to mind. The first is going with my school friend Jack for lunch when we both were at meetings in the city and enjoying a good lunch near the Houses of Parliament. And as the bill arrived, both of us offered to pick it up and charge our expense accounts. We had a laugh and said, who would have expected that two sketty schoolboys would find themselves in that position some 40 years later? The second experience was near the end of my career in industry, and I was finding myself getting out of a cab and walking into the offices of a merchant bank with a set of documents to finalise the sale of the company I worked for from its US owners to a European company for some £1.5 billion, and I wasn't even getting a percentage. On a trip to London, we'd looked up at the statue of Nelson atop his column in Trafalgar Square, and I was not to suspect that one day I would put my hand on Nelson's head. I knew one of the directors of the company that was contracted to clean and renovate the column and statues in the square. I was working in an advisory capacity with them on business planning. They had scaffolding up the column and a platform at the top around the statue where the cleaning was being done. Before our meeting that afternoon, in the more hospitable surroundings of the Institute of Directors, I was invited to take a trip to the top of the column to see Nelson. I'm not a great fan of heights, but when I was told that fewer than 30 people had been up there, including the Mayor of London and the Blue Peter film crew, it was hard to miss the opportunity. I have a photo of me in a hard hat with a nervous expression and my hand on Nelson's hat, with the National Gallery looking like a matchbox below. As I pressed nervously on the stone of the head, probably trying to cool my hand and lower my blood pressure, I rather alarmed my guide by saying, "It feels as if something's moving." The swift answer was, "I hope it's only you or the bloody scaffolding. So thank you, Adrian, but it's not something I want to repeat, so don't order the scaffolding just for me." Although the trip to London was exciting, and the 14-hour car journey was certainly memorable, of equal impact and certainly causing a greater degree of anticipation was our first holiday in a Bucklands holiday camp. In the 1950s, to working families, or at least those with children, this was akin to a trip to the Seychelles, only with funfair rides. The experience has crept back into the public conscience through the TV series Heidi High. And from memory, it seemed to recreate at least some of the experience with some accuracy. It was in the summer holidays when I was 6, approaching 7, and my brother was 3 years younger. Some classmates had already been and came back with tales of unlimited free fairground rides, talent shows and games, large swimming lidos and glamorous theatres and ballrooms where children were allowed in for milkshakes and lemonades and ice cream sundaes. It all sounded too good to be true. And where was this extravaganza for the senses to take place? The hard-to-pronounce North Wales resort of Porthcawl. I'm not sure if we travelled there by coach or car, but I guess it seemed a long journey to an eager six-year-old. Family photos of the holiday show my brother and me bizarrely wearing cowboy hats in most of them. Cowboys were big in the 1950s due to the pervasive influence of post-war American culture on our TV and cinema screens. How many of us recall the names of such Western heroes as the Cisco Kid, the Lone Ranger, or Kimosabe, as he was known to his native Indian and somewhat downtrodden sidekick, read a sort of buckskin butler named Tonto. He was played by a Canadian actor by the glorious name of Jay Silverheels, who research tells me was a star lacrosse player in his pre-buckskin days. The masked Lone Ranger seemed to display more affection for his white horse Silver, and many days Tonto must have yearned a return to the more egalitarian world of lacrosse. But other interesting conjecture exists around the relationship of these two, with the suggestion that as Tonto in Spanish translates as stupid or crazy, the term Kimosabe means idiot in Apache. Whatever the truth was, they had more glamorous and credible names than Hopalong Cassidy, who is clearly some early attempt at equal opportunities hero. I digress. There are other photos of sitting in and steering small cars around a track, still wearing cowboy hats, in rowing boats or model railways, electric rocking horses, and what appears to be a not very realistic but full-sized mechanical elephant. One of the amazing observations is that at Butlins I appear to be wearing a collar and tie with the cowboy hat. My brother is more equinely authentic, wearing a set of reins, very fashionable in the 1950s for child control, and now probably outlawed under the Geneva Convention. The accommodation was certainly not luxurious and would appear very regimented in more recent times. Some of the camps were converted barracks, and the chalets, think terraced wooden single-storey huts, were very accurately portrayed in Heidi High. One attraction to parents was the presence of a chalet maid patrol at night so that parents could leave the children for the evening and go to a film or a variety show, safe in the knowledge that the patrolling maids would call on the tannoy if they were needed. Unfortunately, this was to happen to my parents when their visit to a show was interrupted by a call for residents of Chalet X to return to attend to their children. My mum would recall the incident all too frequently for my liking, that upon returning to the chalet, they found a small crowd outside accompanying the chalet patrol, who was shining a torch through the window at me sitting on the floor, bawling my eyes out and nursing a nasty bite on my arm inflicted by my brother during some argument over positioning in the bunk beds. Photos of other activities during the holiday suggest the feud was forgotten, but I don't know how many more evenings out my parents enjoyed that holiday. I mentioned earlier that summer holidays in those days are often spent with relatives, and it was also the case that if the annual holiday destination was near to or en route for any old acquaintances or family members living away from us, the opportunity was not missed to see them. This was not as if childhood did not already have enough tea times at relatives' houses, being told how much you'd grown and answering mild interrogations about what you'd learned at school. And you were meant to be on holiday, for goodness sake, and having a rest from the rigours of learning. Nevertheless, there could be bonuses, like the brief period of rabbit ownership following a visit to Uncle Jim's in Wiltshire. On a later holiday in either Bournemouth or the New Forest, we visited my mum's Auntie Lily, not very memorable in itself, but it must have been pre-arranged, as she mentioned that her son, my mum's cousin, was at home from sea and had asked if we had time during our holiday to be shown over his ship. It was readily agreed that this would happen the next day, and although it was exciting, my parents had kept from my brother and myself the name of the ship. Living in Swansea with busy docks at that time, it was not exactly unusual for guided tours of ships in port. And in my childhood, we took regular tours of ships in the docks, usually on a Sunday afternoon, and we had seen frigates, destroyers, minesweepers and submarines, as well as some merchant ships. Perhaps my dad was reliving his seagoing youth, but probably not the Dunkirk evacuation. That morning, we drove into Southampton docks in our family Morris Traveller. I'm sure security was more lax in those days. We walked down the quayside to be towered over by a huge shape with multiple gangplanks and Uncle Frank waiting at the bottom of one. "Welcome to the Queen Mary, come aboard." It was one of the biggest things I'd ever seen and dwarfed the town buildings at home in Swansea. I don't know what position Frank held aboard, he certainly wasn't the captain, but in his smartly pressed uniform and his acknowledgement by a few members of the crew we met made us feel very important at the time. We were shown some of the cabins, large plush ones and smaller ones, and his laughter when I asked him whether his quarters aboard would like that was quite telling. My strongest memory was of the indoor tiled swimming pool and a small street of shops on two levels with a wide staircase joining them. It was soon time to leave, but it was certainly the highlight of the holiday for me. My parents were diligent in our education away from school, so we visited castles, museums and historic sites, both from home and when on holiday. Arriving at Stonehenge not long after dawn, following a nighttime journey, isn't something you forget in a hurry, and my dad was quick to tell us that it was thought some of the stones themselves had arrived from the Preseli Mountains in Pembrokeshire, so we felt some regional pride in the site. In those days, the stones weren't fenced off, so they could be walked around and touched, more trusting and relaxed times, or a better behaved public. We also visited Glastonbury Tor and Avery, but to my shame I was more impressed by the model village at Burton-in-the-Water and debated with my dad at home over the feasibility of some limited recreation in our small suburban garden, using shoeboxes as moulds and cement as he always seemed to have half a bag of it, going slowly solid, in the corner of the garage. It never happened, but it was a childhood dream. I mentioned earlier that the family were temporary owners of a static caravan on a site in North Gower. It came to us by way of my mum's brother, Arthur, who was something of a childhood hero of mine, being an army captain, as well as the source of parcels of exotic items sent to us from his postings overseas. He died tragically early, I believe, of long-term health complications, having been a prisoner of war in a Japanese prison camp. We only kept the caravan for 1 year, but it provided joyful escapes at the weekends and school holidays. Years later, we acquired one of a similar size and vintage for our garden in Sussex, which was used as my wife's studio and a 1950s personal vintage museum. Caravan breaks were wonderful, as after a cooked breakfast, my dad drove back to Swansea if he was at work. Along with my brother and with a friend who might be staying, we would head to the beach through the sand dunes, accompanied by the dog, under instructions to return for lunch. We joined up with other groups of children and played games of football or cricket on the beach. Rock pools were explored and the beach combed for treasures, normally odd pieces of driftwood or shells. I don't recall any valuable discoveries. There was the constant need to deter Patch from sticking his nose in washed-up dogfish or jellyfish. Caterpillars were collected in jam jars in the dunes. It was a famous Five style of adventure, without the sailboat or improbable encounters with pirates or gangsters. Caravan life is like living in miniature, with everything to hand or under your feet, depending on your mood. I think the caravan had a series of rooms that were created by folding screens. There was a sink and a cooker, but I don't recall a fridge, but wouldn't have noticed one, and food could be bought daily in the shop on the site. The toilet / bathroom facilities were in a shower block on the campsite. I don't know if there was any electricity. Most probably there were gas mantel lights, all very retro. I don't know whether it preceded the caravan or whether it was a byproduct of my dad's time in the Sea Scouts and later in the Army, but he was an enthusiast of camping stoves. These were normally used to boil a kettle for cups of tea, possibly after one of the frequent impromptu roadside car repairs. Occasionally some soup might be heated for us, or to drink out of Baker-like mugs. One of those outdoor gourmet experiences was the subject of an early and rare success in the world of writing. We were asked in school, somewhat ambitiously in retrospect, by our class teacher, Miss Sharp, to write on the subject of our best day. I don't know what the rest of the class of 7 or 8 year olds wrote. Tales of birthdays, Christmas, or trips to fun fairs, or maybe a day at the Butlins holiday camp. I was rather embarrassed to be called out in front of the class to read my masterpiece out in probably one of my first spoken public appearances. So no doubt, with my ears glowing bashfully, I read out my account of a recent day trip out to a river near Llandilo with my mum and dad, when my brother and I fished in the water with nets and jam jars for minnows before enjoying a fry-up of eggs, bacon, sausage and fried bread cooked in a frying pan on my dad's stove. I do remember it then and now as a beautiful day out, and I now realise that my teacher recognised and appreciated the joy in simple pleasures and wished to celebrate it. Perhaps for me it was the first time that a piece of my writing was appreciated, so I thank her for that.